Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. That is July 1st. Oh my God, it's July already. But I want to remind everyone that we Zoom our show on the afternoon before. So if something should happen on June 30th at night, we're not going to be talking about it tomorrow. But actually, we're very okahan. You will see why. So before we begin our show with our first guest, I want to remind everyone that we always hear the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman when he testified before the impeachment hearing of 2019. It's not okay. It's not okay, Dad. He assured his father it was okay. It ain't. It ain't okay for him, not for his brother, not for the country. Frankly, I'm not even sure it's even okay for the world. So I just want folks to know that we're living in challenging times. All right, everyone. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, you're going to hear this voice between now and the election of November 2020.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
We haven't talked to Joshua Keating for a while, but I love him. So I, like a good little doobie, go a couple of days ago to the slate.com and I see, oh, isn't this great? As America closes its borders, Europe considers banning Americans. This is a presidency built to keep people out of the country, not to govern it. We are being joined by the senior editor at Slate. He also focuses on international affairs. So let me welcome him to the program. How are you, Joshua?
I'm all right. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Well, that line that is so fabulous that I looked at when I was reading your article is, this is a presidency built to keep people out of the country, not to govern it. The result is that the disease continues to spread with no end in sight, and that American citizens are now global public health pariahs. The reason I want to start with that sentence is, just as you're coming on, the EU announces the countries that can actually be partners in travel and come visit the EU. And it turns out, shock of shocks, we are not one of those countries. And then I noticed that CNN had done this remarkable graph looking at how the EU has addressed COVID-19, and then looking at how the United States has addressed COVID-19. And the gap is disgusting. So let's start with how you begin your story, because it isn't even about the EU. It is about Donald Trump and his quote unquote plans for immigration, or in this case, basically sealing off immigration.
Yeah, well, I mean, sometimes two news events happen close enough together that they kind of put each other in relief and sort of reveal some additional significance to each other. And, you know, last Monday, Trump signed the executive order that suspended workers using H-1B visas. So these are skilled employees. And he did this over the objections of most of the American business community, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who said it would, you know, stifle efforts to for the economy to recover after the pandemic. But, you know, it's really kind of the latest example of the administration using the pandemic as a pretext to implement more immigration restrictions. I mean, he also extended by 60 days the restrictions he had put in place in April. And, you know, we've already seen the administration's basically ended the U.S. asylum system. And a lot of this isn't going to be felt that dramatically immediately, just because most visa processing is shut down because of the pandemic anyway. But, you know, this is the kind of stuff, I mean, if Trump is still in office next year, I mean, could be a real lasting change to the U.S. immigration system. So, you know, we talk a lot about how dysfunctional this administration is and how it, you know, can't do anything right. And, but, you know, you have to give them credit. They have been effective on this in terms of sort of implementing, you know, what I would say is sort of a racist, almost white nationalist immigration policy. They have been pretty effective at that in really cutting down the amount of immigration, not just, as they say, illegal immigration. This is, these are people who, you know, who they like to say did it the right way, who applied for visas, who have, you know, the kind of skills that would help the U.S. economy, that would help our medical system recover from this pandemic. You know, these are the people we're now keeping out of the country.
Well, a powerful paragraph, and I want to read it to you because I want to then comment on it. You write, but by eliminating the H-1B visas, Trump is closing the door to exactly the sort of high-skilled immigrants he's talking about. He's always saying, you know, that's why he wants people from Norway, because they must all have PhDs and be blonde and blue-eyed, but whatever, that he's talking about, that he wants to be able to be a gatekeeper and have people with skills and money and qualifications. Well, H-1B visas are exactly that, so why did he do this? And then you went on to say, even medical workers are barred, with the exception of those working directly on the coronavirus. The order does make an exception, and this is where I want to talk to you about it. The order does make an exception for those who can, quote, provide temporary labor or services essential to the United States food supply chain, close quote. This suggests that contrary to its rhetoric, the administration is fine with having immigrants work in America's fields and slaughterhouses and livestock, but not those that invent software or work in its hospitals. It makes clear that what we should already have been obvious, that the administration's goal is not stopping certain kinds of immigration, but stopping immigration full stop. In this goal, the Trump team has been remarkably effective. So I want to go back, and as I was reading who he's going to allow in, the people that can work in the fields, the people that can work in the slaughterhouses. You know what he would really like? He would like to return to slavery. That's what he would like. He sees these people as chattel. He doesn't see them as human beings. If you can be in our slaughterhouses, and if you can work in our fields and pick our lettuce, so I don't have to really sort of care about you, and be temporary, that's what he wants. He wants servants. He wants slaves. He just doesn't want immigrants. And it's just so depressing to realize what he says. And what's so ironic is that he talks about this sort of racist policy, but in a funny way, those people that are coming in to the fields and the slaughterhouses are not going to be coming from Norway. They're not going to be coming from Sweden, and they're not going to be coming from England. So let's call it what it is. He's so disgusting. And yet if you actually play it out and you color code it, you know exactly what he's doing.
Well, you know, it's one of those things. I think the pandemic in a lot of ways has exposed, well, we use this phrase, essential workers, that we see now who the people who the system would actually, you know, our civilization would actually just collapse if we didn't have them. Right. And so, you know, I think it's been clear that, you know, that you do, in order to just keep food on the shelves, there are a certain number of people who have to be let in. So exceptions were made there. But beyond those essentials, I think that this is being used as a pretext to keep as many people out as possible. And I think you're right. I think this whole idea of, well, the distinction made between legal and illegal immigrants, these are clearly legal immigrants. They're people who have gone about it the legal way. And they're people who supposedly have the skills we need. I mean, you know, he's talked about doing like an Australia or Canada style point system that would let people in who have, you know, all these great skills we need. And, you know, those are the people who are being left out now. So.
Well, and as it points to the Canadian system and whatever, right now, we don't have that system, but the closest thing we have to that system is the H-1B visas.
Right.
So if you want to look at sort of the variation on the Canadian theme, that's those visas. What did he do? He canceled those visas. So you know, he throws stuff out as if to distract you, but what you actually play out what he's saying, he does the opposite all the time, Joshua, all the time. Ken, you wanted to weigh in here.
Joshua, you talked a couple of times about people entering the country the legal way, and yes, people applying for H-1 visas are perfectly legal, but I just want to make clear to our listeners that the asylum seekers who are not treated so kindly by the Trump administration are also perfectly legal. They're coming the legal way. They come to the border as they have a legal right to do. They voluntarily present themselves and their credentials to a Border Patrol agent. They're not apprehended, although ICE uses the word apprehended to count them, but they voluntarily show up and say, I'm here because I want to apply for asylum because I fear persecution back in my home country. And they have a legal right under U.S. law and under international law to do that. So they are a legal applicant also.
Yeah, Ken, I think that's a great point. And I think both this move on H-1B and the, you know, further restrictions we've seen on the asylum system have both been ways of sort of eliminating the legal pathways to entering the U.S. So, you know, so it's all very well to say, we want people to come here legally. We want them to do this the right way, you know, right, to get in line and do it properly. But, you know, that doesn't really work if you're cutting out all the
avenues,
all the avenues for them to do it. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. He's pulling up all the drawbridges.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about what's happening to us, because while the United States is now shutting its borders to the world, as you point out, the world is doing the same to the U.S. So you point to what happened on Tuesday, but today is Wednesday, and today we notice that the EU has issued its list of countries, and the countries are actually quite fascinating, actually, when I look at them. I mean, some of them are not surprising. I'm not surprised to see Australia on the list. I'm not surprised to see Japan on the list. New Zealand, everyone wants to move to New Zealand. South Korea, but this is where I'm thinking, Morocco, Rwanda, Serbia, Tunisia. I'm like, wow, they're doing a good job. And the reason why I think the list is so powerful is that how the EU came to this list, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Joshua, is that they looked at the science, they looked at the statistics, they looked at how they're addressing COVID, they looked to see how their curves were going versus our curve was going. So they have this respect for real sort of information and documentation. So this list is a very powerful list of who's doing it right. And unfortunately, when you look at who's not on the list, excuse me, Russia, Brazil, the United States, and then you look at what we have in common, we suck when it comes to addressing COVID-19, which is why the CNN storyline where you see this incredible graph was just shocking, because it really sort of hits home how much we're failing.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, you know, at one point, Europe was the epicenter of this crisis. And, you know, Trump, of course, banned travelers from the EU back in March. And I actually think there was some logic to that at that point. You know, since then, the trajectories have really diverged sharply. You know, they've been moving sharply down in most European countries, possible exception of Sweden, and then that's happened even as they've reopened their economies in the last couple of weeks. Meanwhile, the numbers in the U.S., in Brazil, and a few other places have been going sharply up. So, you know, and I think it is an interesting list, because it shows it's not just the kind of wealthy Western countries that you'd expect that have done a good job. There are some developing countries that, you know the limitations of their own health systems and know they're particularly vulnerable and took steps very early on to control the virus and have now, you know, seen the results of it.
Let's be honest,
it's a kind of diverse group of countries.
Right. And yet wealth doesn't equal control. In some ways, wealth almost undermines control. Because when you look at all the things, I listened to Dr. Fauci again this morning, when you look at the things, the mantra, more than even testing, the mantra is social distancing, wearing a mask, and, you know, and basically sort of avoiding big crowds and doing whatever. Those are not expensive things. You can be in Tunisia and social distance. You can be in Rwanda and wear a mask. And that's part of the irony here. It's kind of the behaviors that are going to ultimately control the spread of this disease because of the whole community spread. And they have been able, in part, because they know they don't have a lot of ventilators. They know they don't have a lot of ICUs. So does their population. And I'm kind of wondering, Josh, if there's almost a crutch here, because we think we have such a great healthcare system, because we think we have so many doctors, because we think we have all this healthcare, that therefore we can get away with bad personal behavior because we have a fallback. But in some of these poorer countries where they know they have no fallback, because most of them have never even seen a hospital. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out what explains our just unconscionable behavior. And in part, I also think it goes to the leadership of the president, who has basically made the idea of mask wearing. If you wear a mask, you're not voting for Donald Trump. That's what he equates it with. And that's what his followers think. So they think that in order to prove that they're part of the MAGA group, that, you know, it's not just wearing a hat anymore, it's not wearing a mask and being vulnerable.
Yeah, and I mean, these are all, you know, a lot of these are countries that, even if they are poor, have sort of a high degree of, I guess you could call it state capacity. I mean, if you look at, you know, Rwanda in particular has done some impressive things with its health system and then sort of environmental governance and economic development. Georgia, sort of in the same boat. Tunisia, maybe like the only democratic success story that come out of the Arab Spring. It's the only one that's still you could call it a pretty well-functioning democracy. So yeah, I mean, not all these are quite in the same boat. I mean, I note in the piece that, like, there's some ironic here, you know, Trump's always been clear there. It's not like all immigrants he wants to talk out. He said, like, he's okay with people from Norway. I don't know if I can say on the radio that the way he described the countries that he wants to keep out. But you know, you look now the European countries are they're happy to have people from, you know, Rwanda and Vietnam and Uruguay come to them, but not so much Americans. So, you know, what kind of country does that make us?
Well, and that line was just phenomenal, because you really do say, I mean, it makes us the countries that he accused all those other people from coming from. And I guess one of the concerns I have is, you mentioned that, you know, the Chamber of Commerce was so apoplectic about the H-1B visas. Is there any way that he would reconsider this? Because money is influence. He loves to be loved by corporate America. And has corporate America tried to really challenge this? Because, I mean, I'm going to be honest with you right now. If they still claim that they need H-1B visas, I'm not always big on this because I don't want to see American workers replaced, but the workers with the highest technical skills are the ones that are still employed in this country for the most part. They haven't lost their job. They can still work from home. They can Zoom in, they can computer in. So they're still producing at an incredibly high level. But what I'm concerned about is that the one thing he's got to do is he's got to prepare for the November election. Obviously, the Chamber of Commerce is important to him as he wants to prepare for the November election. You would think that the H-1B visa issue would be something that would be so provocative, because my understanding is he shut it completely. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple exceptions I mentioned, like doctors who are working directly on COVID, for instance, would be one. But it seems like, I mean, I'm not a campaign reporter, but it does seem like the strategy is to sort of double down on these sort of culture war, you know, nativist issues. He's really going to focus on that. I mean, it's not going to be a kind of business friendly reach out to the moderates message. That doesn't seem to be the plan.
I know that the plan has never been that. The problem is, I'm not sure whether you call corporate CEOs moderates. I mean, I think they care about their bottom line, and they're massaging their bottom line. And that bottom line goes not only to, you know, their corporate profits, it goes to Wall Street as well. So I'm wondering if there was like a Wall Street effect when he shut down the H-1B visas. I also wonder what the EU just did today, reminding everyone that we air on July 1st, but the show actually happens on June 30th. That's got to be a killer for him, because that, you know, he keeps saying what a great success we are, better than anyone else in the world, number one in the world. And what the EU was neurotic about was actually showing people the science and the math as they came to their decisions. So this is really about looking at facts and data in order to explain why is Rwanda on the list and not the United States. And I'm just, to me, it would seem to be an incredibly crushing blow to him.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I guess he could make it about like, oh, they're just doing this because they don't like Trump, like the, those Europeans, they, because he's been bashing NATO and the EU since the beginning. So like, just be, oh, they're, well, we have the best testing and everything. They're just, you know, this is just spite because I banned them, you know. I don't want to be feeding talking points to him, but
No.
I can imagine how I can kind of hear how this could be spun going forward.
So as you look forward going into this, a lot of these are like 60 days, they're extensions of whatever. Is there any kind of an appeal process to this? Is any way that Congress can step in? I know the Senate doesn't do anything except they're lapdogs for Donald Trump, but I'm just wondering if there's any way of sort of arguing against some of the things that he's exercised in these executive orders.
Sure, and a lot of these executive orders, you have to like wait and see how they're implemented too. I mean, that ban he put in back in April, was it? You know, the initial tweet was a complete shutdown of all immigration to the U.S. And then when you actually looked at the fine print, oh, there were like a lot of carve-outs and exceptions. So I think like as with all these orders, we have to wait and see what the implementation is going to be, because there's always the initial announcement and then the actual order turns out to be a little less than was promised.
So we know that you can't travel to the EU. That was the list that came out today. Is that generic travel in the sense that they're looking at tourism, or is that all travel in the sense that if you are doing business in Germany, if you are doing business in Sweden, whatever it is, not Sweden, I don't think it's part of the EU, but if you're doing business in those countries, are you able to still participate and travel there? Or is this just generic? Because they talk about it being travel partners. And travel partners to me implies tourism. It doesn't necessarily imply other things. Do we know how restrictive the EU line of demarcation is?
No, I believe it's all travel. I should know, the U.S. government still is advising people to avoid international travel anyway. But I believe it is all international travel, and that doesn't, if you're a European citizen living in the US, there are, then you can go as long as you self-quarantine after you enter. And this doesn't apply to the United Kingdom, which is no longer part of the EU. But it is pretty sweeping.
No, the government doesn't care if you're over there as a tourist or over there as a business person.
I also think it doesn't apply to Ireland either, which is an EU member but is outside the free movement zone. So
wow, it's gonna be so interesting to see how people react. But it isn't surprising as we look at this going forward. Joshua Keating, I'm glad you came on today. It was a perfect opportunity. I think we are one of those SHIT countries now. I'm so glad we've arrived, formerly known as the United States. But at the same time, the numbers don't lie. And I think what we're seeing is a whole change in behavior and panic happening in a lot of the very sort of conservative states. And now when you throw in what just happened with the EU, I think the airline industry must be out of their mind. If they're already terrified by who's not traveling, now a very lucrative travel was between the US and Europe, and that now has completely evaporated. So I think that's going to be another situation that's going to add to the economic downturn in the United States. Thank you so much for joining us, Josh Keating. I appreciate it.
Oh, anytime, Arnie. Great to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Ken.
Josh Keating writes for Slate.com. He writes about international stuff, like visas. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1928. That was the day the state of Alabama outlawed the convict lease system that had been in practice for decades. Slave masters throughout the South had routinely loaned out enslaved people before slavery was finally abolished. The convict lease system continued this practice as the South worked to rebuild in a rush of rapid industrial growth after the Civil War. African Americans found themselves increasingly subject to sweeps by local and state authorities duties that coincided with harvest time or when labor agents arrived looking to man the coal mines. Many were convicted on trumped-up charges and shipped off to prison. Once there, they were leased to private industries and dispatched mostly to coal mines near Birmingham. By 1890, the state profited $164,000 a year. By 1912, prison mining brought in over $1 million in state revenues. In the PBS documentary, Slavery by Another Name, Douglas Blackman and other scholars note that prisoners could be driven in a way that earlier enslaved workers and free labor could not. Convict labor served to depress wages, curtail union activity, organizing, and strikes. These workers could also be worked practically to death and easily replaced. Progressive reformers, Socialist Party leaders, and United Mine Workers District 20 would wage an unrelenting war against the convict lease system for years. Even the 1911 Banner Mine explosion that killed 123 African-American prisoners couldn't outlaw the practice. Finally, newly elected Governor Bibb Graves yielded to the public outcry that condemned the practice as a relic of barbarism. He also ceded to workers' demands for jobs. Graves subsequently put prisoners to work on chain gangs building roads throughout the state, making Alabama the last state to abolish the convict lease system.
Olé, 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 olé. Olé, 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 olé.
Yes, sir! Yes, girls!
Of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Again, a reminder that we tape this show on June 30th, but you will hear it on the 1st of July. I go to theconversation.com all the time. I love it. I enjoyed reading this article, but it made me frickin' depressed. The title of the article is 100 Degrees in Siberia, Five Ways the Extreme Arctic Heat Wave Follows a Disturbing Pattern. Joining us right now is the author of that piece, Professor Marcus Cerez.
Cerez.
He's a research professor of geography. He is the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado at Boulder. So I was mentioning to Mark just before he came on the air that I have an affinity for what he does because I used to live in right above Hanover, New Hampshire. And Hanover, New Hampshire had the Cold Regions Research and Environmental Lab, which was a place that did a lot of what you do, I suspect, at the University of Colorado at Boulder. So I got to hang out with a lot of guys that spent a lot of time in the really cold weather. They went up to the Arctic all the time, or they reproduced the Arctic at Krell, so they could practice when they went up to up there. But I wanted to share just a really quick story, because you said you love the Arctic. And I have to admit, I can't quite imagine loving a lot of blue ice, but I think I have to say that maybe I'm wrong about that. My best friend is 100 years old. She's 100, okay? And when she was 86, she took a trip to the Antarctic at 86. And she has lived all over the world. Her husband was a engineer and he would design huge dams. And so she would go all over the world. So there isn't a continent she hasn't lived on. She came back from the Antarctic and said it was the most amazing place she had ever been in her life. And she looked at me and she said, I want to go back before I die. And knowing that she's lived everywhere, it was kind of intriguing to me that she would find something so quite remarkable there, but she absolutely did. And to this day, she talks about it all the time. So Mark, what is it about the Arctic? What is it about the Antarctic that is so incredibly seductive and exciting that people like you and my 100-year-old friend just have fallen in love with it?
Well, for me, I mean, I grew up in snow and ice. I mean, you grew up in Hanover. I grew up in Kennebunkport, Maine, okay, southern Maine, okay? And we're, especially back then in the 60s, we had real winters, right? So I really loved the snow and ice. I would do crazy, I mean, we did daredevil sledding, crazy stuff like riding ice floes down the Kennebunk River, almost drowning, ice skating, all kinds of things. We loved snow and ice. Winter was my favorite season. And when I first went to the Arctic, which was, oh, way back, it was May of 1982 to study these two little ice caps, got off this Twin Otter, ski-equipped Twin Otter aircraft, got off, and I realized I'm home. You know, this is it. It was just after a snowstorm and the sun had come up and every snowflake on the ground was just sparkling like little mirrors hitting at me. And as the plane left, what I remember most after the plane left was the absolute silence. Where in the world can you go where there is absolute silence? You can hear nothing. And it was just this pristine, quiet environment that just hit me. And ever since that, I've been hooked.
Well, you've been going back a lot. You started in 82. So your arc of history is pretty significant, especially in light of, I mean, it's not significant when you look at the age of the planet, but it is significant when you look at the exploding changes that have been happening because of climate change. And what is so amazing is that in that short period, because it really is a short period, you even write that you have seen dramatic changes and that you could actually see them is what's so frightening. But we now are beginning to get it because your article begins with 100 degrees in Siberia. I mean, I may never go to the Arctic, but I know 100 degrees in Siberia, there's something rotten here.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, the changes that I've seen, well, I write about it in my book, The Brave New Arctic, that came out a couple of years ago. These were little ice caps. I was studying energy, mass balance of them. And we looked at the most recent satellite imagery. They are gone. They're dead. And this is one of the things that really brought the issue of climate change in the Arctic.
Mark, as I'm reading your piece, one of the things that you point out is that you not only have you seen the change that's happened since 1982, but that there are so many, I mean, you talk about the five ways the extreme Arctic heat wave follows a disturbing pattern. But what I keep seeing is, if you look at each one of them, it's synergistic. Each one almost aids and abets what is ultimately the failure and the heating up of the Arctic and the melting of the ice caps. And I don't know how any one of them are gonna disappear. So I don't know how this heat wave is a one-off. I think it's in perpetuity unless we do something about climate change.
Well, we've always had heat waves, just like in the middle latitudes, you have heat waves and you have winter cold snaps. And the same as in the Arctic, it's always been that way. But what's happened now is that we've had this general warming of the Arctic. The Arctic's warmed at twice the rate of the rest of the globe as a whole. So now when you have a heat wave, it's superposed on top of that. So the heat waves are hotter and the cold waves are not as cold. And that's what we're seeing now. What we're seeing now with this heat wave, it's an exclamation point on a trend towards a warming Arctic with losing the sea ice, losing the glaciers.
So let's talk about all the different things that are adding to this heat. Because when I started looking at it, by the time I get done at the end, I'm thinking, oh my God, it's going to be Miami Beach by the time we get done here. Because I looked at all these and I am trying to figure out how any one of them adjusts in a way that is better for the Arctic and not worse for the Arctic. So talk about all the different things from what's happening with the permafrost to all of it.
Yeah.
I want my audience to see the building blocks.
Well, what we're doing is we're losing the Arctic sea ice cover. That's the floating ice cover of the Arctic. The biggest changes are end of summer, 13% per decade. Basically, if you think about where we were in September 1980, where we are like in recent years, you can think of it as losing all of the states east of the Mississippi, plus the Dakotas and Iowa and Nebraska. That's the sea ice cover. The ocean is warming. Now, permafrost, which is perennially frozen ground, is warming across the Arctic, and some areas is thawing. Dramatic changes to the landscape when that happens. We're seeing plants change. We're seeing treeless, windswept tundra being transformed into shrubby vegetation. We're seeing species move north that we didn't see before. Beavers and moose now entering the Arctic where they didn't before. So it really, and we're seeing impacts in the food chain all the way from like phytoplankton to the top predators. So it really is a very, very holistic change. The whole Arctic ecosystem is really responding or changing in concert with the climate changes that we've been seeing. Now, of course, you've got like the Greenland ice sheet, Arctic ice caps and glaciers melting down, and those are big contributors to sea levels. So the Arctic seems so far away, it really isn't.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about what we have. You mentioned the Siberia and 100 degrees, but we're also seeing this huge oil spill and we're seeing fires. And what I've been reading, I'm wasn't sure if it's in the conversation or other things I've read, but that permafrost you were talking about, that's now so unstable because now it's being exposed. They are saying that one of the reasons for the oil spill is because of the permafrost.
That's
so again,
right.
I mean, explain to people what the permafrost is. Why would something with the permafrost have to do with an oil spill? I want them to see the dots.
Well, permafrost is perennially frozen ground. Now, when permafrost is stable, it's like concrete. To knock it out or dig through it, you really need a jackhammer. Okay? It's basically a glue that holds sediments together. But when you start to warm and thaw the permafrost, the glue is gone. Now, it's perfectly fine to build structures on permafrost as long as you're careful in how you do it, like build buildings elevated above the ground to circulate air underneath, things like that. You can build on permafrost if you do it right. But when the permafrost itself starts to thaw, you're in big trouble. You can't go back. The genie's out of the bottle by then.
Well, and so you've got this oil spill, which is a problem. You've got the loss of the permafrost, which is a problem. But now they're talking about the fires that are happening there. And they're even suggesting that they're seeing these new fires, but they're wondering whether the fires ever went out. Like they ask that they're more permanent because there's a lot of bog material. And so again, all these things are feeding into, I think, the kind of climate change that we're trying to address, but we're actually now aiding and abetting the climate change unintentionally by what we're doing with the Arctic.
Right. Well, think about the permafrost, okay? When you have more forest fires, that will help to degrade the permafrost because what you've done, you blacken the surface. That black surface absorbs more of the sun's energy so you can thaw that permafrost. Kind of the southern edge of permafrost, and we were doing permafrost research, and I was just amazed at the burn areas, thousands and thousands and thousands of acres that burn. Now, most of these are lightning set. Most of them are naturally set. But with an Arctic that is warming, these forests dry out, and forest fire is more likely.
So let's talk a little bit about the jet stream. Because my understanding was that the jet stream was pretty much of a constant. But yet, when I read your article, I'm realizing that the warming weather is affecting how the jet stream is moving. And to some extent, am I correct here? Does the warming weather slow it down?
Well, it may. Now, whenever we have like a warm snap or a cold snap, you can associate that with changes in the jet stream. If you have a real cold snap, you're in what we call a trough, an area where the jet stream tends to dip to the south. If you're in a very warm period, it's where the jet stream tends to meander to the north. Now, that's always happening. That's just weather, right? But there is very serious research out there arguing that if we warm the Arctic strongly, which we are, Right? That could itself influence the jet stream, influencing not just Arctic weather, but weather down in the middle. But it is a big wild card out there, and a lot of people are studying it.
So what do we do? And what does it mean, Mark, to have this happen? So we're looking at it as happening up in the Arctic, and we're looking at sort of the issues that are happening up there and the warming and everything else. And obviously we're going to see, you know, sea level rise. We already know Miami's going underwater. But I'm trying to figure out what other consequences are there from what you're seeing in the Arctic, number one. And number two, is there any way we can sort of stop the acceleration that we're seeing happening up there? And I ask that question for a reason. My audience has heard me tell this story. My husband died of cancer. But before he died, he had radiation on his throat. Okay. Mm-hmm. And what happened was that he begged his doctor to stop because he was losing weight. He couldn't swallow. He couldn't sleep. He couldn't breathe because it was just so swollen. And here's what the doctor said to him. And he said, okay, we're not going to do the last two radiation treatments. But what you have to understand, Marty, is that you will still cook. You will still cook. And I get the sense that no matter what we do, the Arctic is going to still cook.
Well, it is in the sense that there's what we call heat in the pipeline. We haven't even caught up with the amount of carbon dioxide we have in the atmosphere today. So we are, but this is not something that cannot be stopped, but you need to be acting now. And my view is that the most important thing we have to do is change the mindset of people, how we think about energy, how we use energy. When I talk to children, I say, look, you know, you might think that turning the lights off when you leave the house is just a drop in the bucket. Well, that is, okay? But when we start to do things like that, we start to change how we think about the problem, how we think about energy and what we're doing. That's how we're going to beat it. All this talk about, carbon taxes and like that. But if we're going to beat this, we as a people need to start to understand the problem. And so we need to change the mindset. It is not too late, but we need to act.
Are the Russians worried about this? My concern is that countries like Russia are looking at places like the Arctic and seeing it as a gold mine for natural resources, for more drilling, for more opportunity when it comes to financially. And yet, as you know, I mean, we start out by talking about Siberia being 100 degrees and this oil spill that, you know, I mean, it's wonderful. You want to go get your oil, but guess what? You don't have permafrost. So, you know, how are you going to build those facilities? Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering whether it's even sobering them up that, you know, all this opportunity financially is actually going to be undermined by what it does to the entire planet.
Well, to paraphrase Mr. Spock, you know, our species does not behave logically. We would smarten up a little. I mean, Russia understands this. You know, I work with Russian scientists. They well understand this. It's interesting that the Department of Defense is very on board with this. The Navy understands what's happening. The Army understands what's happening. They see it, right? And they're going to have to deal with it. So this idea that, you know, some of our higher ups don't get it or refuse, well, maybe we see that in our politicians, but we're kind of counts out there. It is very, very visible. I've talked to these Navy people and they say, I don't care why we're losing the sea ice. What I see now is I have a blue ocean now I didn't have before. Now it's my problem. Tell me what to do. These are the questions they're asking. So the we're turning around. I think we've passed a turning point. In my own opinion, I think we're passing a turning point and we're gaining momentum, but we have to keep hitting on it. We cannot be complacent.
What do you mean by we passed the turning point? Are you saying that we're like, it's like a come to Jesus moment? And we're beginning to figure it out, or are we past the turning point in the sense that we really can address this galloping climate change? And what we're going to have to sort of do is either figure out how to control it, live with it, address it. What turning point are we at, Mark? I'm not even sure.
I would say that we're probably at both. We're kind of at a turning point in that, darn, we better do something about this or we're in big trouble. And that has in turn led to being close to the turning point that, yes, we are going to address this. I am hopeful. I remain optimistic that we're going to beat this, but we have to start now. There's two turning points here.
All right. So you've been going up to the Arctic since 1982. It's now 2020. I'm going to make you the czar of climate change. And mm-hmm. I'm going to say, if you were elected in November and you wanted to address this, one, the U.S. can't do it alone. I get that. But what would be the first three essential things that we have to implement in order to do this? All of them are, I'm sure, are going to make changes in our lives. But here's the good news. The pandemic has made changes in our lives.
Yeah, true enough.
We're in change mode anyway. You know, I haven't driven my car and I won't even tell you how many months, you know? I mean, I'm looking at my own personal behaviors and I've already had to adjust because of the fear of contracting COVID-19. This may be the perfect time mm-hmm. to start talking mm-hmm. about how to address climate change because we're already in a brave new world. You know, knock me out. What would I do?
Right. Well, there's several things. And I say one of them, and it's a longer term thing, is education. If we're going to beat this, we've got our level of science education in this country is deplorable. We've got to get it. Why can't we have, the technology is there for cars to get 50 miles a gallon. There's nothing really reason we can't do that. Conservation is simple. We can do that, right? There's been a lot of talk about like a carbon tax. I think that's a good thing to do. That we're making great inroads in renewables, okay? You know, solar and wind, they won't solve the problem by themselves. Of course they won't. The magnitude of the problem is huge, but it's a start. And that is also this start of changing the mindset. So those are some of the things that I would certainly want to do if I was in charge.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've thought a lot about, I mean, I believe in the democratization of energy. So I really do like the idea of having a solar panel or geothermal or the conservation or the wind, maybe a little wind turbine on the top of my house. I want to have that connection to energy. Yeah. One that I know that in some ways it's more, how do I say this? I feel more secure because I don't want to be mm-hmm. part of mm-hmm. some kind of a grid. And that's helpful. It's also more sustainable because everything I'm talking about is not going to do damage to the environment. But, you know, as I'm looking at, you know, the Green New Deal and I'm looking at what's happened as a result of the pandemic, we're going to be spending more time because I think we're going to see more and more pandemics. So we're going to be spending more time a little bit isolated at home. Yeah. And that means home is going to be a very important place. But that means that conservation has to start there, Mark.
Yeah, I would agree.
And I know I used to be a poverty worker. And one of the things we had these weatherization projects. Where we would go in, but we didn't have a lot of money. You know, we could like fix some doors or, you know, fix some windows because they only gave us a couple of $1,000 to work on these places that were leaking like sieves. I think that if we could spend a couple of billion and actually address conservation across the board, especially in light of the pandemic, you will have changed what people have to spend on energy. You will change the level of comfort for people. You would change the impact on climate change. It has such a win, 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 win that in some ways, conservation needs to be, I think, the first thing out the door.
Right. Well, just to say, example, I probably in the past several months cut my carbon footprint in half, at least. Why? As scientists, okay, we are used to traveling across the nation in jetliners, traveling to conferences and things like that. We don't do that anymore, okay? What do? We use Zoom. Or other means of communication. And you know what? It works. It works just fine. So we're really changing. I think this is really going to change how we work, how we operate. Not all of us are going to be able to work remotely. That's obvious. It's not going to happen. But a lot of us can. And so, yes, I think we need to take advantage of this, you know, the silver lining on the cloud, as they call it, or something like that, of this pandemic, because it is already changing our behavior in the right direction.
And you know, you were starting to go to the Arctic in 82. You fell in love with it. When was the last time you were there?
Last August, when I was looking at permafrost. So okay. I'm not going to go this year because our field work has been canceled because of restrictions and things like that. So I will not be going. But how do we get to the Arctic? We fly a jetliner, right?
Right. So I'm looking at this 82 to 2020. What I'm trying to figure out is if it was so dreadful in such a short window, if we behaved better and if we started to adjust our behavior, could you in a relatively short window begin to at least start to undo the damage that we've done? Or will we, by changing our behavior, at least stop the damage from accelerating?
We could limit it. In other words, we could stabilize things. Okay. All right. We still have some warming in store, but if we were to here 100 years from now, if we don't do anything, we could stabilize things. We'll have to live with some warming. Okay. There's no way around that. That's the reality. But the longer you wait, the worse it is.
Well, I'm going to thank you very much for joining us. And I'm going to just tell my audience, we had obviously Zoom issues with sound quality, but you know what? You're seeing that on MSNBC and CNN, so I don't feel so bad anymore.
Exactly. And this is where we're going to be going.
Well, and now we're going to have to stabilize Zoom is what we have to do. Not
that's
just
right.
Mark Series is a research professor of geography, and he's the director of the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado Boulder. I hope you get to the Arctic next year.
So do I. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you so much. Ciao. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow.
Folks are laying down their arms, children and lovers wait with open arms. No more alarms. The creatures of the world are free, clean are the waters and the air we breathe. It's not make-believe. Things can change to green. They could be better than they've ever been. For you and me. Whoa, whoa. Things can change to green. They could be better than we've ever seen in history. Doing the things that they should, all of the things that they know are really good. Yeah, it's understood. See the world with less of gray. See the fears of the people go away and stay away. Yeah, things can change. Change the